from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Trump hasn't held a press conference since July, but released a video last night talking about his agenda for his first 100 days in office.
Trump tweeted on Saturday, and then again this morning, saying the cast and producers of Hamilton, which I hear is highly overrated, should immediately apologize to Mike Pence for their terrible behavior.
Richard Spencer, he's the man who actually coined that term alt-right. He was in Washington this weekend. He was spewing, as he often does, I mean, what I can only describe as hate-filled garbage.
We learned early this morning that Donald Trump has canceled his meeting with the New York Times.
President-elect Donald Trump's meeting with staff at the New York Times is back on for today.
I think when the president-elect, who's also the head of your party now, Joe, tells you before he's even inaugurated he doesn't wish to pursue these charges, it sends a very strong message, tone and content to the members.
That's some of the week's news for you. I'm John Dankosky. As we talk about the week's news, if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You will notice that an awful lot of the week's news, as gathered in sound bites, is about Donald Trump. We'll obviously be talking about the president-elect, but there's a lot more to talk about as well with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Welcome back, Colin. Good to see you once again.
I'd like to point out that I actually canceled my appearance on this show and then reinstated it later.
You thank you.
It was touch and go whether I was going to be on or not.
I'm glad that you were able to make it back for us. Kevin Rennie is here. He's a Hartford Current columnist. He also blogs at dailyructions.com, a former Republican state senator and representative. Hello once again, Kevin.
Good morning.
And Christine Stewart is here. She's editor of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hello, John.
At the end of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about how to deal with the pending Thanksgiving conversations, perhaps about politics with your family. Should be a fun year. Let's start here, though. In a New Yorker piece, Jelani Cobb, formerly of the University of Connecticut, talks about the defiance the states are feeling toward President-elect Trump in tone and policies. State Democratic leaders in California and New York have released statements saying they will protect their most vulnerable communities. Andrew Cuomo from New York quoted, "Whether you're gay or straight, Muslim or Christian, rich or poor, black or white or brown, we respect all people in the state of New York." I found this interesting, Colin, just because when we use the term states' rights throughout the history of at least recent politics, we think about that as Republican state leaders trying to assert their rights over a tyrannical federal government. This feels like something entirely different, and I don't know if it spreads beyond New York and California.
First of all, it's a little premature, right? I mean, Trump's policies are so murky, including maybe to himself, that knowing what would be an appropriate state response it seems a little premature to me, but it is an interesting thought exercise anyway. And yes, absolutely, this has ordinarily been an exercise perpetrated by Republicans. But there may be interesting ways. The immigration part of this in some ways feels to me like a cheap date with your conscience. I mean, I actually think that'll be a relatively easy thing to deal with, particularly if his policy is as it's currently stated. The latest iteration that I know is that he has a policy very similar to President Obama's, that he's going to go after, you know, active criminals who are immigrants, which is hardly a radical thing to do. So I'm not so sure how significant that'll be. I think the more interesting question will be if, in fact, the Trump regime includes a lot of things that seem very disappointing or punitive in other ways. And once again, I think it's premature to say that states can be these crucibles of innovation where, you know, you can try something that the federal government doesn't seem to be able to try. My guess is that one of the places this might happen will be in the area of healthcare. If there's a, you know, significant vitiation of Obamacare, I think you'll see states trying their own experiments.
And I want to get from the rest of our panel the idea of if states from like Connecticut can be crucibles of innovation. But first of all, your broad thoughts on this notion, Kevin, of states maybe taking a look at what Trump eventually comes up with as policies and saying, no, we're not actually going to play that game.
50 laboratories, they're out there to be used. And it's one of the ways we got comprehensive welfare reform in the 90s was that states were given waivers to experiment with their own programs. And eventually what worked, I think, was incorporated into national policy, and what didn't was discarded. So there's nothing new about this. Everybody needs to calm down a little bit. And, things, for instance, we got the 55 mile an hour speed limit in America by threatening to take away highway funds. And so there are limits to experimentation when the heavy hand of the federal government decides to put conditions on legislation, and that will not be a first either.
Well, exactly. I guess one question I have for you, though, is so much you said everyone needs to calm down. Colin said it's obviously premature. We're not sure what the Trump administration plans policy-wise. We clearly didn't hear a whole lot of policy specifics during the course of the campaign, and we haven't really yet. But I think whether it's state leaders or leaders of the Democratic Party or people across the country who are speaking up and saying we will resist what these policies are as they come forward, they're reacting to the rhetoric that we hear, and the rhetoric can be very harsh. I guess I'm wondering, Kevin, how we divorce those two things, how much we should think about what a president-elect says, how much we should take that to heart versus what actual policy prescriptions then go into place. A lot of the reaction is just about the things that he said, which scares, well, frankly, a hell of a lot of people.
Well, he's a liar. And so that's not a surprise. That's one of the few things that will not change in his tenure as president. He doesn't tell the truth. He says what he thinks will be to his advantage at the moment, and that's not going to change. I mean, one of the things that, you know, the whole lock her up, you'd be in jail by now with Hillary Clinton, was disturbing at the time, but it's also disturbing that the president-elect of the United States intervenes in some sort of investigation or whatever it is and says we're not pursuing this. That's really not the president's job. That is the job of law enforcement, and that people should worry most about. That the rule of law is really under threat from the Oval Office.
What do you see in all this, Christine? Is states like New York and California, where Hillary Clinton won rather handily, where they start to speak up about the policies that they see forthcoming?
No, I see that definitely happening, and I see Connecticut, taking a lead in that, and I think on the healthcare front, also on immigration, that Connecticut will be vocal about what it believes, and how it believes we should move forward. I guess some of the danger in that is, as far as the healthcare goes, is the funding the state receives from the federal government, and what's going to happen with that, and how do we sustain the systems that we currently have in place without help from the federal government.
We've been used to a Governor Dan Malloy who will speak up when provoked by Republican national actors quite often. What have we been hearing from the governor along those lines? It feels as though other governors, perhaps those with greater approval ratings in their home states,
which
have been
be
a little
almost
bit
almost every one of them.
fair enough.
Except one, yeah.
have been speaking up. Have we heard anything from the governor saying, "Look, we're going to defend, health care here. We're going to defend immigrants' rights"?
No, I think he has said. I asked his office before the march on Monday, where the immigrants' rights groups walked down Main Street in Hartford. How he felt about making Connecticut a sanctuary state, much less a we have some sanctuary cities here, but what about making it a sanctuary state? And, his statement from his spokesman was pretty supportive. So I don't know where we go from there. I think it's kind of a wait and see attitude to see what happens with Trump and the federal government.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to what Kevin was saying, I mean, like every 24 hours, there's a radical revision of what Trumpism is. So yesterday he met with the New York Times. And yes, he's not going to prosecute Hillary Clinton anymore. He's much more open to the idea that climate change has a man-made component after completely discarding that notion.
No, he did think it was a man-made component. He said it was a hoax from China.
Hoax from China. Okay, there you go. I guess in that sense, it's man-made.
Yes. But
I mean, there were two or three other, pretty significant modifications, even in terms of his tone towards the press. Somebody asked him toward the end, what can we expect from you vis-a-vis the First Amendment? He said, I think you'll be happy. And so that's why it's very difficult to sort of say what Connecticut's reaction to Trumpism should be. I have no idea what Trumpism is going to be. But with each passing day, there's a modification of it that seems to make it drift towards the center rather than towards the outside edges. You look at the people that he's appointing, and it looks like he's appointing people towards the outside edges. You look at the stuff that he says, And, you know, he's more centrist by the day.
And Kevin, I like your reaction to that, but I just want to weave in some of the, you know, the tweets that we're getting from people. And this is a lot of what we talked about actually last week is that there are an awful lot of people who are political observers, people who watch this on a daily basis, who can say, well, look, much of what Trump is going to do is going to drift toward the center. It always drifts toward the center. We can say wait and see because we're not exactly sure what it's going to look like. It sounds scary right now. But we're hearing from people all across America and certainly right here in Connecticut tweeting at me, you know, it doesn't feel premature to us non-white citizens. Trump is surrounded by white supremacists. The idea that for an awful lot of America, there's not really a wait-and-see attitude when they hear the rhetoric over the course of the campaign and they see what's been happening since then. Is that sort of another divide that we have in America right now? The people who are saying, okay, it's going to be okay, and the people are like, no, man, this is a huge problem for us right now.
Well, I'm not saying it's going to be okay.
Yeah. Nor am I.
I think it's going to be terrible. Yeah. But he's not in office yet. He's not exercising authority yet. So we do have to see what sort of government he forms. And then, you know, we start to see, for instance, I think he said to the New York Times, he's a little surprised at the Republican resistance in resistance in Congress to the idea of spending another $1 trillion. And that would be on, well, so-called infrastructure, what they call infrastructure, that our institutions do continue to work. And they will act as a, I hope, as a break on his terrible instincts.
Colin, I just wanted you to weigh back in because I know that you're not saying that. I guess that what we're hearing an awful lot, most of the emails I'm getting, frankly, from people are somewhere along those lines.
Yeah. So, look, one thing I've been saying to people is that there are two possible scenarios. One of them, and I think it's embodied in the emails and tweets you're getting, is that what this really is an attempt to completely destabilize many of the bulwark protections of the American government, done in a very genial and smiling fashion. But that if you were the kind of group of people who were planning to dismantle as much of the democratic protections as you could and substitute for them a much more authoritarian style of government, you wouldn't act much differently than the Trump group is acting now. However, that doesn't constitute proof that that's who they are, because there are also a lot of other signals they're sending on the other side. I actually think that Trump first of all, I also think we've got to be careful about what we say. I mean, just to be accurate anyway, Trump isn't surrounded by white supremacists. He has a guy on his staff, Steve Bannon, who was prominently associated with the alt-right, was certainly involved in publishing some very white nationalist stuff. But I'm not sure that there's anybody else anywhere near Donald Trump right now that you could call a white supremacist. And white supremacist might be a little bit too strong for Bannon. I mean, there's some strong language you could use about Bannon. White supremacists might be going a little bit too far. So I don't know. People who tweet and send emails, they can say whatever they want. In the news business, we have to be a little bit smarter about how we actually describe people and what verbs we use. I don't think Donald Trump is surrounded by white supremacists right now.
Bannon, however, Kevin, is not just a guy in his White House.
Oh, no,
he's his chief advisor.
Bad. It's terrible. I don't know what else to say. It's terrible.
Let's just quickly
it's
get
terrible.
This. Steve's in Hartford. You know what? My phone thing doesn't work. I can't put Steve from Hartford on the radio. Let's try to do that in just a second. I just want to quickly, before a break, Christine, you mentioned the idea of Connecticut saying, well, should we be a sanctuary state? The mayors of some of Connecticut's largest cities that consider themselves to be sanctuary cities have said, we're going to continue in this vein. Of course, it's under the threat that, you know, much needed funding from the government might not be coming their way.
Yeah, and the governor has said that, you know, look, we're gonna sue the federal government. We'll sue Trump if they try to withhold federal funding from our cities because this is the way we've decided to act.
But the federal government puts conditions on virtually every piece of, yeah. of funding legislation, and no one should be surprised if this becomes another one.
Colin, of course, it should be noted that as we go into the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the Connecticut players who we'll see over the course of the next couple of years. heading into a gubernatorial election, heading into a really important midterm election. There's somebody like Mark Bowden who kind of made his name around this idea of sanctuary cities or not.
Yeah. So for Mark Bowden, who's the mayor of Danbury, has been elected many times now, about 10 years ago, he was very concerned with making Danbury an anti-sanctuary city. He was campaigning very actively against this immigrant population, and his government seemed to be involved in this pretty unattractive sting operation where I think 11 people were led into a van and being told that they were taken to some kind of wonderful job site or maybe a horrible job site because immigrants have to go there too. It turned out to be an ICE sting. At least one of those guys spent 5 years in prison. Ultimately, there was a judgment of $400,000 against the city of Danbury. They agreed to pay that anyway, and $250,000 against the federal government. For a while, Mark Bowden, whose exploratory committee for governor was announced yesterday, you know, he was kind of a hero of that movement. He was going on the Lou Dobbs show and talking about it. He has since, you know, turned himself into this teddy bear who tweets about old school hip hop and The Walking Dead, and he's just loads of fun. But yeah, way
but
back when.
He's still a xenophobe.
Okay. That was Kevin Rennie.
Would you like to expand on that?
No,
Kevin?
I think that was calculated, and that came from some real place within him. And I don't think he's sorry. I don't know, Colin. Has he ever said he's sorry?
I don't think he's ever said that he's sorry. I mean, interestingly, you know, Danbury ultimately has kind of benefited from its vibrant Latino population that he tried to quash.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, maybe we'll consider some of the other people who are going to make inroads in the Connecticut political scene. We're talking with Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant and DailyRuxions.com, Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and our own Colin McEnroe. Maybe we'll fix the phones and you can talk to us. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. A happy Thanksgiving week to you. I'm celebrating with Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, who brought hot toddies, I think, for everyone. I like your thermos. That was very nice. Kevin Rennie is here. He's a columnist for the Hartford Courant. He also blogs at DailyRuxions.com. And our own Colin McEnroe is back with us once again. What's on your show today, Colin?
We have this culture panel, The Nose, that ordinarily meets on Friday. But this being the week that it is, we're meeting today. We're actually going to talk a lot about the way comedy, late-night comedy in particular, is sort of a canary in a coal mine for changing political climates. It's the first group of people who culturally respond to a big change like this one.
That's this afternoon, a special Nose this afternoon with Colin McEnroe. Let's quickly go to the phones. Steve from Hartford was trying to get on before, and my phone system wasn't working, but it's all fixed now. Hey, Steve, go ahead. You're in the Wheelhouse.
Hi, everybody. Maybe this has already been settled, but can we go back to the very first question with regards to Connecticut, New York, California, the legislatures, the Democratic leadership staking out very, very firmly that they will oppose some of what Trump's rhetoric has been. Colin then went on to say, well, people can tweet whatever they want, but the press has to be a little bit more careful. But the distinction between what somebody says they'll do and what is actually happening is already happening in a sense. I was at a mosque on Friday for an interfaith prayer service where it was discussed a significant uptick in FBI calls to Muslims and to the mosque itself directly as a result of the election. So people don't need the press to tell them what's already happening. How is it that we make that distinction when the Connecticut legislature or the leadership in New York firmly comes out and says, affirmatively, we will resist. Mm.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for the phone call. I'll put that first to Colin. And what I was hoping to do maybe today, and maybe we'll never be able to do this in a world in which the press seems to be disliked so much and under attack from so many different quarters, I wanted to resist having a conversation that was navel-gazing about the state of the press, because we could probably have that conversation all the time. But Steve brings up a point about how clear the people in our job can or should be about some of the things that are going on, about the positions we may or may not stake out, the words we might use. when we talk about, you know, the alt-right or white supremacists, or how much we pay attention to swastika taggings in high schools in Connecticut, et cetera, et cetera. I guess I'm wondering if you have a quick thought for Steve on this.
I think being tough, fair, clear, accurate, these standards don't really change all that much. And so, yes, there are alarming activities going on which deserve to be reported upon and deplored when appropriate. And so certainly what happened at Wilberforce High School, where he recently did have, or there at least their athletic complex, I think, where you had something like that happen and recently. That stuff is really horrible. And if, in fact, it's true, I mean, this is the first I ever heard about there being an uptick in FBI checking on Muslims or mosques. I mean, it's something you, once again, it's something that you would need to document a little bit more than on an anecdotal level. It's also a little odd just in the sense that Trump isn't sworn in yet as president. Why would the FBI be enacting some policy that they imagine that he has? All I'm saying, look, I was as opposed to Donald Trump as a human being can be. I was absolutely as horrified as anybody else could possibly have been when he gets elected, but when he got elected. But now I think our job is, I mean, we don't want to turn into a fake news site, right? We don't want to be reporting stuff that's distorted or that anticipates something that really happened. The only way that we can really command the respect of people is to be really clear about what's true and what's not true. And so, you know, and in some ways, that's not that complicated a standard. And that's the only one that I'm kind of invoking today. It's like we can't really talk about policies that don't exist yet. Yes, I'll just say one more thing, which is that Stephen Colbert and John Oliver did this thing in Montclair, New Jersey a couple of days ago. It wasn't really open to the public, but there's a little bit of footage leaking out. And Stephen Colbert said, apropos of what Steve is saying, I listened to everything he said on this campaign. You know, I listened very carefully, and it was horrible, and we can't give an inch on that stuff. And I totally agree with that. I know what he said during this campaign, but I also agree with Kevin. He's a liar. And as a result, he's not going to – I mean, the wall's already turning into a fence, you know? I mean, I don't think he's going to be able to stick to a lot of this stuff. And, you know, if they'd elected Paul Ryan as president – Paul Ryan would die on the cross for the stuff that he believes in. If they told him, nope, you can't reform entitlements, he would say, I don't care what I have to do. I'm not leaving here until I do this because I believe in it so passionately. There is nothing in Trump's lexicon that he feels that way about. There just isn't. You know, there isn't anything he would die on the cross for except more applause. So,
that's not a small consideration, Christine.
You know, I think that the press in general struggled with this during the campaign, struggled with calling out Trump for the statements he made that were false statements. I think as we got towards the end of the campaign, I think even you saw, you know, basically the New York Times and some of its reporting being like, that's a lie, that's a lie, that's a lie, and coming out and, you know, making sure that their readers knew that this was not a truthful statement coming from a candidate, and it contradicted other statements. So I think that we've already had our moment where we've I guess, realized that Trump is a liar and that, you know, we need to make sure that we are reporting accurately what is happening.
Kevin?
The most disappointed people over the next couple of years won't be the people who oppose Donald Trump. It's going to be the people who supported him.
I agree.
Because he is not going to deliver.
That's already happening with a failure to prosecute Clinton. And, you know, there are groups going nuts right now because they thought that lock her up stuff was real.
They thought what he said in the debate to her face, you'd be in jail right now. They thought that he believed that words had meaning and that meaning was attached to those words. But it doesn't. And so I don't know. They're going to be the most disappointed. I don't know why they should be surprised, though.
He's not an ideologue. He's not. So
he has no fixed beliefs.
No, none.
I mean, he was absolutely crystal clear about tearing down Obamacare during the campaign. Within days of being elected, he was saying, well, I think there's some elements of that that deserve to be preserved. His next aperçu is going to be, well, a lot of those elements are knitted into the structure of not only Obamacare, but now all federal health programs. It's going to be very hard to unspool the ones that you like and then throw the rest away. It's going to be much more difficult than he had imagined. And thing after thing is going to work like that.
It was upheld twice by the Supreme Court. Yeah.
The Supreme Court.
Upheld on its constitutionality because it was viewed as a tax in Congress.
Well,
the
individual mandate was
but it doesn't mean that the Congress was not given the right to make changes in it.
Yeah, you can still get rid of it.
It's not an amendment to the Constitution.
It's true.
But may I just add one other thing?
Absolutely, please.
For the last 8 years, the press has been pretty indulgent of the President of the United States. And this is going to be a big change, and people are going to notice that the press is acting very differently toward this president than they did toward President Obama, and really more the way they acted toward President Bush. But the press should just do what its natural job is, no matter who the president is.
Let's move on to some things that are happening in the wake of the election here at the state level. You wrote about this last week in your column, Kevin. It's not just that we saw a change in the Connecticut State Legislature where now the state Senate is tied 18-18, but it seems to come with a real potential, at least, for the Republican Party gaining some momentum to be able to co-lead a government that has been controlled in total by Democrats for such a very long time. What do you see in all this? I mean, what do you see coming out of this upcoming legislative session as Len Fasano is already calling for joint bipartisan talks to take a look at the problems with the budget? I mean, how big a deal is this that we've got this 18-18 tie in one house of the legislature?
It's big. It's big because we have this tie at a time when we're facing probably more than $3 billion in budget deficit over the next two-year budget. And as we sit here, no one knows what to do. There's not $3 billion out there to raise taxes, or there's really – if anyone knows where there are $3 billion in cuts in the budget, they're keeping that a secret. And so it's just a very difficult time, and it's an opportunity. It would be anyway, but a greater opportunity because of the new partisan divide for people with ideas to put them forward and to have them enacted into law where that was not – they had no chance of that before.
Have you – I'll ask you first, Kevin. I'll turn to Christine on this because she's there at the Capitol every day. Do you know where those ideas are coming from? Are they as hard to find, those people with those ideas, as maybe the $3 billion in cuts that we're talking about here?
Oh, I think there have been ideas out there on what to do on benefits reform and contracting and state services. But it's not – you know, there's not one you can point to that said, oh, there's $3 billion over in this corner that no one has noticed. It's going to be piece – it's going to be piece by piece by piece. And, you know, if you have an idea that can save $20 million – you are going to be fed it at the state capitol because that's what they're going to be looking for. It's going to take many small pieces to this puzzle.
No, it definitely is. And I mean the hard part is the unfunded pension liability that we have and the level of debt. The amount of spending from our operating budget that is going towards our fixed costs.
Right.
And that's a huge problem. And if they had been able to solve that problem, literally the last public meeting they had on solving the pension problem was in April. Apparently, Ben Barnes and the head of the CBAC coalition, Dan Livingston, have been meeting privately to see if they can come up with a solution. But there has been no solution yet. So there are no easy answers out there.
So what does it look like with the Republicans now at the table in a greater way? I mean, how does it change any of the dynamics? Because the thing you just said is, I think we can all agree, one of the bigger problems, right? Any negotiations about solving any problems are happening behind closed doors. None of us know anything about what's being talked about. Maybe at least something gets out in the open. I don't know.
So what's interesting is that the last time that Republicans were allowed into the room on some of these tougher structural changes, they agreed with Governor Malloy. And Governor Malloy didn't necessarily agree with his Democratic colleagues in the House or the Senate. But he really didn't have – the Republicans didn't have enough power to say, you know, hey, we need to stay in the room. We need to talk about this. Weren't able to convince the Democrats that that's where they needed to go. Governor Malloy was convinced. He's okay with voting on union contracts. And, you know, so he's, you know, in step with the Republicans on that. So I think that the Democrats are really going to have a hard time this year.
Because the Democratic legislative leaders really protect what they see as their prerogatives. And one of them is disdain for the Republicans. And they did not want the Republicans in the room. They wanted to work out the budget on themselves. They had no interest in any other ideas. That's just the way it is. And now it's changed, and they are the voters have changed that. And they're disoriented as about what's ahead and how to continue to exercise their powers. You change with an 18-18 split, the budget of the state Senate, which is not $3 billion, gets changed. The Republicans get more. The Democrats are in a are feeling very nervous and emotional over it. They're like they're going to be in the next room from Kanye West when they have to give up some of that money.
Colin,
all right, yeah. There's so much about this that's very interesting. So, and in a way, I thought the next sound you hear will be Larry Cook typing an email. It would have been fine.
Larry Cook he works for the Senate Democrats. Just for the insiders or yeah. Outsiders who don't know.
Sorry.
In a way, it would have been fine if it went 1917 and the Republicans took control. Right? I mean, success has many parents. Failure is an orphan. There's going to be a lot of failure up there. There's been a lot of failure up there, and so everybody would like to sort of sing the Billie Jean tune, "The Kid Is Not My Son." But, the more involved you are, the more access you have, the more that you have to take some ownership of these problems. I don't think anybody has any magic solutions or any magic bullets. We would have heard about those by then. I do feel like, at minimum, Len Fasano, the minority leader of the Senate, he's barely a minority leader anymore, right? It's an 18-18 tie. There are two Democrats, as Kevin has written, who are very reliably peeled off from the Democratic majority. But then you start thinking about it as a chess game, and you start thinking about some of the unpopular things that are going to have to happen. And if you're the Republicans, you might be saying to Paul Doyle and Joan Hartley, no, why don't you stay over there and make Nancy Wyman cast a deciding vote on some of this stuff? Because Nancy Wyman is a very probable, or possible anyway, contender for the gubernatorial nomination on the Democratic side. So you want her to be a parent of some of these things too. So you might see the Republicans preferring the 18-18 split to other kinds of deals that they could cut, at least on some of these unpopular measures, which are all of them.
I do think, though, unpopular measures, there are fewer of them than there might have been a few years ago, because I do think the public understands what has to be done, and that they're willing to endure cuts in programs that help balance the budget without a tax increase.
Well, and tax increases?
No, I don't think that I don't think that they're ready to endure tax increases, because we've had so many already. What we haven't had are spending cuts.
Hey, go ahead.
Well, and let's see what happens. The House Democrats are proposing giving everybody who lives on Social Security a tax break, from the income tax, which is $47 million, which in addition they'll have to find in the budget.
Are we going to see an upcoming legislative session in which, Christine, you think we will have some of these conversations about the big things that will structurally solve the problems? Or are we going to see another session filled with these sort of little tiny money grabs where we're going to make $30 million here and $40 million there, and people will hold press conferences and pat themselves on the back because we're getting closer to solving a problem that's actually as deep as the Grand Canyon?
They have to solve the issue this year. They have to deal with the big structural problems this year, because there is no more money left in the couch cushions.
Also, we had a little problem with our bonds, state bonds, in a recent offering, that the interest rate that the state has to pay came in considerably higher than what they expected. And that's a sign that our financial markets, which are bloodless, are losing confidence in Connecticut. And that's a very dangerous.
How did it take that long, actually?
Three of the four bond rating agencies have downgraded Connecticut.
Yeah, I'm sort of wondering how it took that long.
I was just going to say, yeah. Bill Clinton said one of the biggest surprises of being president was the power of the bond market.
Mm. Well, let's take just a look at some of the players who are actually making a difference up there right now. You wrote about one of them, somebody that most of the people who follow Connecticut politics not all that closely doesn't really know about, Liz Karanowicz, and how she was able to, in some ways, help to make this move for the state Republicans.
Yeah, there are not, there's not really a class of professional campaign people for the Republicans in Connecticut, simply because there's not a way to sustain them as to make a living. But she has managed to become a force in the Republican Party and now in wider politics. And she's able to raise money. She's able to find people to donate to these independent committees. And she's very shrewd, particularly this year, at deploying those resources. And so she raised $400,000 and went out and bought broadcast and digital time and was thought to have had a real impact on some of the campaigns.
And she was the first one to do this. She was the first one ever in Connecticut to use independent expenditures.
Yeah.
I will say that I was at the first debate with Liz, and she was among the Republicans, I think it's okay to say this, who were looking at a Clinton victory as the most incredible fundraising opportunity in the modern history of the Republican Party. They were thinking, we are going to be fat, you know, for 10 years if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency. So they kind of have to go to plan B right now.
I just want to hear a little bit of tape. This is Congressman Jim Himes. He was talking on WNPR's Where We Live yesterday, talking about how Democrats are feeling right now.
Well, there's no question that when you lose, and when you lose as unexpectedly as the Democrats lost, you know, obviously with the precedent on down to the House, where I think we, right up until Election Day, had the hope or the expectation we might win, you know, if not certainly not the House majority, but, you know, somewhere between 15 and 20 seats. And, of course, we wound up significantly lower than that. I think there's at least two conversations that need to be had. Number one is, what did we get wrong? And I think, you know, that conversation is going on in a very robust way right now in the Democratic caucus in the House and elsewhere. But then there's also a larger conversation to be had. What does it mean for our country if the person who gets almost 2 million more votes, 2 million more Americans saying, hey, I want you to be president, doesn't get to be president?
So that's Jim Himes talking on Where We Live yesterday. Actually, he raises two points that we could probably spend a whole lot of time on separately, Colin. I guess I'll have you address the first of the two, though, having to do with what the Democrats do now. Yes, obviously a lot of hand-wringing at the national and at the local level. I wonder if at the local level people are thinking about and asking the question, what did we do wrong, in quite the robust way that perhaps national Democrats are. But what do you see in that?
I don't know. I stopped listening after a while. But they have to make deals. You know, Chuck Schumer has already figured this out, right? That, you know, you can be the loyal opposition about some of this stuff, but you also – this is a guy who likes to make deals. And so that's what you're going to do. And at times, in all of the ways that Kevin suggested that Trump may drift out of communion with his original base, those always present opportunities for you to cut your own deals. You know, I think Himes is in a very – he's one of the many people who's in a very odd position. You know, all anybody talked about in terms of him during this election cycle is that Clinton was going to win. He was going to be offered, you know, a pretty good job somewhere within the Clinton administration, which he would probably take unless the Democrats took the House back, at which point he could have some kind of really good leadership or committee. Well, I mean, that was all just, you know, pie in the sky, you know. I mean, not only didn't – I mean, none of that happened. So if he sounds a little, you know, loopy, it might be because, like, really, he personally doesn't really have a good play right now.
A month ago, we were talking about the end of the Republican Party. Now it has more power than I think probably since the 1920s. I mean, it's extraordinary how wrong prognosticators got it.
But even though that same Republican Party, now that it has much more control, is in like 35 different pieces. It's like this tribal unit with a bunch of treaties.
In a nation of over 300 million people, when you divide yourself into just two parties, those two parties are going to have a lot of different points of view. And that's always the struggle. What points of view are the predominant ones of our two political parties? And I think what may turn out to be more interesting is how the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party it now has its moment.
I'm wondering, Christine, quickly before our break, if you can address that maybe at the state level. You know, Jim Himes is talking about it from his perch in Washington. But do you hear the type of hand-wringing? Or do you get the sense that people in Hartford are asking the same questions about what did we get wrong? How did we lose control of the Senate? How did we lose, frankly, so many races around the state? And just look at that map. You look at all those red towns all over the place. Are people in Hartford, in the Democratic offices, asking these questions about what we need to do differently?
No, they are asking these questions, but I don't think that they necessarily – I think that they know the answers to these questions, and I think that – I'm not sure if that message has gotten to their strategy message of how they proceed yet. So I think they still need to have they still need to come to the acceptance of what exactly happened and then figure out how to move forward.
Yeah, acceptance, I guess, is the first step. Well, we're talking with Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, Kevin Rennie from the Hartford Courant, Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, a few more things to talk about and maybe give you some tips about how to talk about all this stuff at the Thanksgiving dinner table that's coming up next in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking today with Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, Kevin Rennie, who writes DailyRuctions.com and also is a columnist for the Hartford Courant, and Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. Quickly, Kevin, we obviously trying to figure out who all the big power brokers in Washington might be after a Trump administration is installed. Linda McMahon on the list?
Yes, very high on the list. I think she'll get a plum appointment in the Trump administration. She and her husband have close personal ties and financial ties over the years with Donald Trump. And she has been a supporter of his, and I believe she will be rewarded.
What is that Trump job, that plum job? We heard about Commerce Secretary. That's probably not to be. What do you
probably
think?
Probably not, but I think pretty high. I think you know, at the, maybe not a cabinet position, but close to it. Very, very close to it. I just say that. And I leave it at that.
And maybe unless anybody else would like to do it, we will leave it at that.
Say no more.
Did you see that thing where they've actually installed a camera in the elevator at Trump Tower?
Oh,
so
yeah.
you can watch on C-SPAN, like, people coming in or
apparently who's coming in and out.
It's boosted C-SPAN's viewership.
Right. It's like the Yule log of politics.
Yeah. Actually,
watch it.
To be fair, CTN, since we're watching on CTN today, you should consider something like this.
Yeah.
Just pick a random office and see who comes in. Maybe out of this office
here. Put a
camera in our elevator. There's a lot of interesting people in there. Just giving you some programming tips. Christine, quickly, talk about something that you posted. This is sort of a crazy story about this party, this wild party that happened. The Washington Post and Kathy Austin, actually, from the Democrat from Springs, said she's writing to communicate her disgust about what happened at this party. Can you just explain this story briefly, Christine?
Okay, so the Washington Post had an election night party, and at this party, which was sponsored by MGM, there was a server who was wearing a dress, and on the dress were attached the MGM logoed napkins. And so guests were encouraged to take their napkin from the dress instead of being handed a napkin. And so she was very, you know, upset about this. But also her anger at MGM is also directed at their building a casino in Springfield, Massachusetts, which she said is stealing jobs from her district and the two casinos down in southeastern Connecticut.
That is a very tangled little press conference.
It is a tangled one, yes.
That's not one that makes a whole lot of sense.
But yeah. I don't recall her being angry when the Mashantucket Pequots and the Mohegans have been deeply involved in Massachusetts casino proposals that would also, under her view of these things, steal lots of jobs from Connecticut. The Mohegans were at the heart of the Palmer proposal for a casino in Massachusetts right on our border. No one said a word.
But now the state has gotten into league with these two tribes in order to build yet another casino in the state to try to capture people.
Nowhere near
Kevin's town.
Nowhere near a reservation. That's the whole – that is at the heart, the foundation of our two Indian casinos. It was the Indian Casino Gaming Act of 1988. And there's no reservation property in South Windsor, East Windsor, Windsor Locks, or Enfield. And so this proposal is – it's just – it's not right. It's not fair and it's not right. And by the way, South Windsor, where I live, I think is very much opposed to it.
Colin?
I just wanted to say, I mean, first of all, let's be clear. These were Washington Post business executives. It wasn't David Ferenthold and Phil Bump pulling napkins off some semi-naked woman. But, you know, those people, some of those people should be fired. What are they even doing there? They should get their butts back to Washington. It's election night. And even if you're just, you know, some weasel from corporate, you really need to be in Washington where your newspaper is at a time like this, not at a casino pulling napkins off a woman.
And you'd think you'd want to be at the Washington Post
disgusting.
That night of all nights.
It's emblematic of the way in which in journalism, more and more, what used to be considered sort of the publisher and everything, whoever, all the people who went along with the publisher, have divorced themselves from the actual news operation, because it really would have been unthinkable 30 years ago. I mean, first of all, Katharine Graham probably wouldn't have gone to that party. But more than that, there was sort of an understanding, you know, that this is a team and this is the Super Bowl of our season and everybody's there. So I don't know what the hell these people were doing at some crummy casino when they're supposed to be in Washington.
And where was Jeff Bezos on election night?
I hope Jeff wasn't there. But you can order that dress from Amazon.
There's some delays, though. I think there's a strike in Chicago that may keep it getting there in time for the holidays.
We better keep an eye on Kathy Austin's Amazon account.
Right? Well, look, we got a couple of minutes before the end of the show. I know that you wrote about this, Christine. I mean, so many of us have to worry about the conversations that we have around Thanksgiving table, and everyone writes a story about this. But I think this year, especially for members of the press, this is a really weird one, right? You go to a Thanksgiving dinner. You've always got to talk about politics. People want to talk about politics even when you just want to eat mashed potatoes. What do you say now after this very contentious election in which you can't really talk about politics nicely anymore?
You don't say anything and you try to change the subject.
Does it work? I mean, does it actually work for you?
Do you brine your turkey? Do you not brine your turkey? it's going to have to this year in order to make it through that family feast, you know, and these are people that you know, in your family, you might not see all that often. So if you say something that's going to be hurtful to somebody, you're not going to see them again for a very long time. So it's best to change the topic.
Kevin?
I just say I don't want to discuss politics, and no one pays attention to it. I have no authority. And I'm reminded of that various times, most days, when I say I don't want to talk about it. It's too horrible to talk about.
And then they say to you, "Yeah, no, you don't want to talk about politics."
Oh, yes,
but of course you do. Right, and then they launch into the thing, and it makes it very, very difficult. And I don't know, what do you say next? You just walk away?
No, I say I was against him from the start. You know, I was against him from the start. I think he's a loathsome demagogue, and that's how I'm going to talk about him. So if that's what you want to talk about, that's what you're going to hear.
Pass the cranberry sauce. Colin?
Well, my Thanksgiving dinner includes, among other people, Bill Curry. So good luck not talking about politics. However,
good luck getting a word in.
So what I'm actually going to do this year, I teach a class at Trinity. The last two sessions of the class, whenever I do this, involve the rollout of campaigns 4 years from now. In other words, I ask my students to devise media strategies for candidates who would be running this time in 2020. So I need a scenario. I need a fictional scenario in which Donald Trump is stepping down, some other Republican is stepping forward. I think I'm going to have Chris Murphy, just for fun, be the Democratic nominee. So I'm going to have the people at Thanksgiving work on that scenario. Like, what has happened there in 2019 to create a cascade of things that result in these two candidacies? Who's the Republican candidate going to be? And so they can talk about a world that doesn't exist instead of the one that does.
A speculative fiction Thanksgiving, which I think is sort of a nice idea. But before we leave, Colin, I know you wanted to mention this. Whenever we talk around the holidays, we talk about, well, gratitude and a time of Thanksgiving. And when it mixes up with politics, it can sometimes make it crass. I think you have an example of maybe, I don't know, a Thanksgiving message from a politician not being so crass.
Yeah, so we used to have these sort of scholar, poet governors here in Connecticut, and not just one, but Wilbur Cross was one of them. And in 1936, he gave this famous Thanksgiving proclamation. I'll just read the first few words of it. "Time out of mind, at this turn of the seasons, when the hardy oak leaves rustle in the wind, and the frost gives a tang to the air, and the dusk falls early, and the friendly evenings lengthen under the heel of Orion. Very difficult to imagine any of our recent governors writing a proclamation such as this one. But I do read it every year. It goes on, and it's magnificent poetry. Just Google Wilbur Cross, Time Out of Mind, and you'll get it.
That's Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks so much, Colin. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks to Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to Kevin Rennie, Hartford Current columnist, who also writes DailyRuctions.com. Thank you, Kevin.
You're welcome.
A happy Thanksgiving to you all. I'm very grateful for the people who put together The Wheelhouse, including Katie Talarski and Kyle Wolf. Please have a safe and healthy Thanksgiving.